On December 31st, 2019, a 28-year-old real estate agent, a mother of two named Monique Bao, received a phone call. It was a request for an urgent afternoon shower at a vacant house in Maple Grove, Minnesota.
Right, and to anyone on the outside, a New Year's Eve request might just seem like an annoyance.
Exactly. But if you work in a client-facing, commission-based industry, you know exactly what that call represents. I mean, it's an eager buyer.
It's a chance to close out the year strong. It preys perfectly on a professional's drive, their willingness to be accessible.
But the person on the other end of the line wasn't a client. The name was fake, the phone was untraceable, and the vacant house was a trap.
Which forces us to confront a terrifying reality about modern service professions. The very tools that make you successful, your public profile, your contact information, your eagerness to meet a stranger at a moment's notice, they can be seamlessly weaponized against you.
Welcome to our latest deep dive. Today, we are opening up a harrowing and incredibly vital case file from Priyanshu Adithakar's investigative project, The Midnight Ledger.
We are unraveling the conspiracy behind the murder of Monique Bao. This is a journey that takes us from the mechanics of a highly coordinated ambush through a massive 6-year legal labyrinth that just concluded in late 2025.
And ultimately, we are doing a critical analysis of the structural vulnerabilities baked into public-facing careers. So let's break down the core mechanics of Pri's findings inside the ledger.
The timeline of this plot is chilling, mostly because of how mundane it appeared on the surface. Pri's investigation into the ledger shows that the conspirators completely understood the operational rhythm of a real estate agent.
The initial contact, what the case file calls the lure, came from a woman named Elsa Segura. And she wasn't just a random accomplice. Segura was a former probation officer.
That professional background is significant. She would know how to project authority, competence, and trustworthiness over the phone.
Right, because a female voice requesting a showing inherently lowers the perceived threat level for a female agent working alone.
It is a calculated manipulation of trust. And Segura insulated herself by using a burner phone and a fictitious identity.
We hear the term burner phone thrown around in media a lot, but from an investigative standpoint, it provides a massive tactical advantage.
Oh, absolutely. There is no know your customer requirement, no credit check, no government ID attached to the purchase. It creates a digital ghost. A predator can reach into your life, initiate contact, and leave zero verified footprint.
And that digital ghost successfully guided Monique Bao to the vacant property in Maple Grove. She stepped inside expecting to show a home, but instead she was ambushed by two men.
She was bound with duct tape and forced into the back of a rented U-Haul cargo truck. They took a standard real estate listing and basically turned it into a mobile extraction site.
The whole setup reminds me of a Trojan horse strategy. I mean, they didn't have to hack her security system or stalk her in the shadows. They just packaged the attack as the one thing she was professionally obligated to open her doors for a new client.
The Trojan horse analogy captures the mechanics perfectly. The attackers bypassed every natural defense mechanism by cloaking the threat in the guise of opportunity.
And what makes this case deeply unsettling is that predators relying on this tactic, well, they only need two conditions to succeed: anonymity and structural isolation.
Right. The burner phone provided the anonymity, and the vacant solo showing provided the isolation.
But the sheer scale of this orchestration, using a lure, renting a U-Haul, coordinating an ambush at a specific property, that takes intense, deliberate planning. You don't execute a multi-layered kidnapping for a random crime of opportunity.
No, you don't.
So what was the actual motive here?
The motive reveals itself through the terrifying escalation that happened next. The attackers didn't drive the U-Haul to a remote secondary location to hide.
They didn't.
No. While Monique Bao was bound in the freezing back of that idling truck, they drove directly to her own home in Minneapolis.
That is a completely brazen move in the middle of the day. A masked gunman breaks into the residence and opens fire with a .45 caliber pistol, shooting Bao's boyfriend multiple times.
Miraculously, boyfriend survives the ballistic assault. And even more crucially for the investigation, as the police respond to the scene, he immediately names his rival, a man named Lyndon Akeem Wiggins.
That identification cracked the case wide open, revealing what behavioral analysts call a proximate feud.
Exactly. The violence wasn't directed at Monique Bao because of any slight she had committed. She was targeted strictly because of her proximity to the actual target of the grudge.
So they used her to get to him. The boyfriend and Wiggins had a bitter, long-standing business dispute over a record deal. But instead of just attacking the boyfriend directly, Wiggins orchestrated this elaborate plot to strike at his rival's foundation.
It's an act of maximizing psychological devastation. Because tragically, about an hour after the shooting at the house, Bao was taken to a quiet alleyway in North Minneapolis.
She was dragged from the truck, shot 3 times, and left on the pavement.
It is a devastating, heartbreaking sequence of events. But from a law enforcement perspective, the boyfriend's survival changed the entire trajectory of the aftermath.
Because in many targeted crimes, the motive and the suspects remain a mystery for years. Here, investigators had a name, a network, and a clear motive from day one.
The dominoes started falling fast, suspects were rounded up. But having a name and proving a massive conspiracy in a court of law, those are two very different things.
Which brings us to the legal saga that followed. It was a sprawling 6-year labyrinth. The Minnesota justice system had to secure convictions across 4 different levels of involvement.
Let's look at the executors first. Cedric Berry and Berry Davis, the men who physically carried out the ambush and the shootings, their path through the courts was relatively straightforward.
In June 2021, both men were convicted of aiding and abetting first-degree premeditated murder, kidnapping, and attempted murder.
They were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and those sentences held up on appeal. The forensic evidence placing them at the scenes was just overwhelming.
Then you have the peripheral players like Shantae Berry, who received probation for aiding an offender after the fact. But the lure, Elsa Segura, she had a much more complex journey.
She did. She was initially convicted, but that verdict was overturned on appeal. To avoid a grueling retrial, she pleaded guilty in 2024 to kidnapping to commit great bodily harm.
And the judge handed down an upward departure, sentencing her to 20 years.
An upward departure is significant. It means the judge deviated from the standard sentencing guidelines to impose a harsher penalty. The court explicitly cited the extreme cruelty of her actions.
Because she used her professional demeanor to psychologically manipulate a working mother into a deadly trap, the court recognized that the lure itself was an act of profound violence.
Which brings us to Lyndon Wiggins, the architect of the proximate feud. He was originally convicted in June 2022 and given a life sentence. But in March 2024, the Minnesota Supreme Court overturned his conviction entirely and ordered a brand new trial.
Wait, really? When I read that a convicted mastermind gets his case tossed by the highest court in the state, my mind immediately jumps to a tainted jury or corrupted evidence. What actually broke down here?
It wasn't an issue of false evidence or mistaken identity. It came down to a deeply technical yet fundamental constitutional issue regarding jury instructions. The Supreme Court ruled that the district court judge had provided a flawed, hybrid instruction regarding aiding and abetting liability.
Let me see if I can translate that. Does that mean the judge accidentally mixed different legal standards together, which effectively lowered the bar for the prosecution?
Precisely. When the state charges someone with aiding and abetting a premeditated murder, they cannot simply prove that the person helped plan a crime. They must prove that the defendant had the specific concurrent intent for the exact ultimate crimes committed by the primary actors.
So it's like charging a getaway driver with the bank teller's murder. The state can't just say, well, you drove them to a robbery, so you're guilty of everything that happened inside.
Exactly. They have to prove the driver knew about and specifically intended for the murder to take place.
In this case, the state had to prove Wiggins didn't just want the boyfriend roughed up or intimidated, but that he explicitly intended for the kidnapping and premeditated murder of Monique Bao to happen exactly as it did.
And the hybrid instruction given to the jury in 2022 inadvertently blurred that line. It made it too easy for the jury to assume that because Wiggins coordinated a malicious plot, he was automatically guilty of the murder that resulted.
The Supreme Court stepped in to enforce the procedural safeguard. They declared that the state must prove specific intent beyond a reasonable doubt, and the jury had to be instructed on the precise legal standard to weigh that intent.
It has to be agonizing for a victim's family to endure a reversal like that.
Yeah.
But it is the justice system functioning as designed, ensuring the state meets its highest burden of proof.
Which meant that heading into the late 2025 retrial, prosecutors couldn't rely on assumptions about Wiggins' motives. They had to definitively prove his specific orchestration of the final crimes.
And they did that through digital forensics. The 2025 retrial is a masterclass in forensic mapping. Prosecutors brought forward cell site location information, CSLI data, and weaponized it against the defense.
CSLI doesn't just track where a phone is, right? It creates a historical web of connections to specific cell towers.
Right. It paints a temporal and geographic map of a device's movements over time. They didn't just show that a burner phone was used. They pulled the call logs from that burner, mapped its connections to specific towers, during the time frame of the U-Haul rental and the ambush.
And then they cross-referenced it with Wiggins' primary known cell phone. They looked for the digital fingerprint of both devices pinging the exact same towers at the exact same moments.
It is an incredibly difficult narrative for a defense attorney to overcome. You have the synchronous movement of the mastermind's primary device alongside the operational burner phone, correlating perfectly with the physical movements of the rented U-Haul.
They removed the ambiguity of intent by showcasing Wiggins' real-time digital micromanagement of the conspiracy.
The data was undeniable. On November 3, 2025, the jury returned guilty verdicts on all counts. Aiding and abetting, first-degree premeditated murder, first-degree attempted murder, and kidnapping to commit great bodily harm.
On December 22, 2025, just weeks before the six-year anniversary of the crime, Wiggins was sentenced a second time to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Securing final, definitive closure for the Bao family. The appeals process worked, the burden of proof was met, and the forensic evidence ultimately guaranteed the conviction. But here is where his investigation takes a completely unexpected turn.
Right, moving on to our next major pillar, how Pri systematically navigated these operational hurdles. We have the resolution of the criminal case, but what about the environment that allowed the crime to happen in the first place?
As Pri points out in this week's perspective, securing a conviction doesn't change the operational reality of the industry. In this report, Pri uncovers what he calls the Maple Grove trap.
And this is where his dual background is so crucial, because while what Pri is reporting from the ground in Central Ohio is usually focused on institutional capital and macro market shifts, this case in Minnesota proves that operational risk overrides everything else.
Exactly. That's how Pri saw what the spreadsheets missed. Underwriters look at cap rates, but they ignore the physical safety vulnerabilities baked into the business model itself. In his report, he introduces the Targeted Lure Vulnerability Index.
It is an analytical tool designed to expose the exact level of risk baked into standard real estate practices. And when you run the parameters of this case through that index, the results are terrifying.
Let's look at the factors. Factor one, an unverified lead via a burner phone. Factor two, a solo agent. Factor three, an isolated vacant property. When those three elements intersect, Pri calculates the vulnerability at 99%. Critical risk.
It calculates to 99% because that combination creates a zero friction environment for a predator. There are no unpredictable variables, no witnesses, and no digital footprints tying the attacker to the scene.
Think about it like running a 24-hour convenience store. If you own that store, you install bright lighting, you put security cameras on the door, you use a drop safe, and you keep the register till low.
You do all of that to introduce friction. If a criminal sees those countermeasures, they usually move on to an easier target.
But in real estate, accepting a solo showing with a complete stranger is just celebrated as the hustle. You are essentially operating that convenience store at 3 a.m. alone with no cameras and the safe wide open.
No other industry tolerates that level of structural risk, but the culture of the industry actively fights against safety protocols because it views friction as the enemy of a closed deal.
Which is why the countermeasures outlined in the Midnight Ledger are structural necessities. The first step is completely eliminating the anonymity of the lure.
This means implementing mandatory digital identity verification before any field showing is confirmed. You use a two-factor authenticated scheduler app or require a digital driver's license upload through a secure company portal.
If someone calls and says, "I need to see this house right now," the professional's response must be, "Great, please upload your ID to the secure link and I'll meet you there."
A legitimate buyer might find it slightly annoying, but they will comply. A predator, however, relying on a fictitious name and a burner phone, cannot afford to leave a verifiable, government-issued digital footprint.
The moment you introduce that friction, the trap collapses. The predator will abandon the lure.
The second major countermeasure tackles the isolation factor. It's the buddy protocol.
Never entering a vacant property alone. It sounds incredibly simple, yet it is rarely practiced consistently. When multiple agents or colleagues are present, the tactical advantage of an ambush is instantly neutralized.
Because organized criminals seek out easily controllable targets. Introducing a second person introduces an unpredictable variable that disrupts their entire operational plan.
The reality is that the commission-based nature of the job makes the buddy protocol difficult to enforce. Agents are often in competition with each other, and sharing a showing might feel like risking a split commission.
But the economic reality cannot override the physical danger of isolation. You have to remove anonymity and you have to remove isolation. Failing to do so leaves the door wide open to a trap.
It requires a fundamental baseline shift in how the industry operates. Verification and physical presence are not bad customer service. They are the basic requirements for survival in a publicly accessible profession.
Let's pull all of this together. We started by examining the heartbreaking targeted ambush of Monique Bao, a tragedy initiated by a simple, seemingly normal New Year's Eve phone call.
We explored how a proximate feud utilized a burner phone and a rented U-Haul to maximize psychological and physical devastation.
We navigated the complex 6-year legal journey from the Supreme Court's reversal over jury instructions to the triumph of CSLI Digital Forensics in the 2025 retrial.
And finally, we broke down Preeta Thakkar's vulnerability index, highlighting the absolute necessity of digital ID verification and the Buddy protocol to eliminate the deadly combination of anonymity and isolation.
The insights from this case extend far beyond real estate. In an increasingly digitized world, the demands of personal branding require us to be more publicly accessible than ever.
We advertise our schedules, our contact information, and our willingness to connect. The lines between professional networking and personal security are dangerously blurred.
We are conditioned by today's on-demand service economy to view any form of friction as bad business. We want seamless apps, one-click meetings, and instant gratification for our clients.
We celebrate the professionals who drop everything to answer the call. But the tragedy of the Maple Grove trap proves that seamless accessibility can be fatal if it isn't guarded by verification.
Which leaves you with a critical question to consider no matter what industry you work in. When a frictionless customer experience requires compromising your fundamental physical safety, where do you draw the line? At what point does being a highly dedicated, hyper-accessible professional simply turn you into a highly accessible target? Keep your doors open for business, but make sure you know exactly who is walking through them.
But the analysis doesn't stop here. If you want to dive deeper into the data before the next bell rings, make sure to hit that subscribe or follow button right now in your favorite podcast app. If you found value in tonight's reporting, leave us a 5-star review. It helps other listeners find their way to the table. For exclusive updates, show notes, and deep dives, visit our website at bearinvestors.com. Until next time, stay sharp and keep your books balanced.